Well, I first got involved with anti-apartheid in when I was about 15, I guess, in Coventry, when the Springboks tour came to Coventry, and I got involved in Peter Haynes' campaign against the Springboks, the South African rugby team who were touring, and I put little stickers up around the school and tried to persuade people to go and demonstrate against that. I think a couple of us went along, was very young, but that was sort of the first demonstration I guess I ever went on. Can remember that there was a lot of chasing about, police chasing people about, people trying to run on the pitch, and a lot of running about, and I think people got arrested and tried to disrupt the game. I can remember the people going to the match, went through, all the demonstrators were lining the street and sort of booing them or whatever. I mean, one thing I do remember is that the police blatantly had a big gang of vigilantes, just normal people helping them police the event, which was quite extraordinary to see that. And so that's when I became involved with anti-apartheid first. I guess that was when, 1970 or something, around that sort of time. Well, I guess I vaguely have recollections of Sharpeville. I can't remember when that was, but probably as a kid I was aware of it. It was on the news and stuff. And I'd just been into anti-apartheid stuff, just generally I was aware of it, but I got more aware because of the Peter Haynes campaign and the anti-Springboks thing, and that obviously raised the whole issue of sanctions and isolating South Africa and apartheid, and trying to make people realise it wasn't a normal situation there. And I guess that was the main thrust of the activities that people could get involved in outside of the country. That was the main thing they could do, was get involved in the sanctions campaign, I guess. Well, you'd have to be fairly abnormal not to want to do something about it, I would have thought. It was, it was a sort of enclave of Nazism that somehow survived the Second World War, and it had, its links to that have been documented. It was blatant racism. It was more or less slavery by any other name. And it was just completely absurd that it should still be going on at that point in history. It was just an aberration, really. Not as such. I wasn't didn't become a member of any actual group or anything, but I just sort of generally supported the cause. And then I guess later, when the specials were formed, there was Rock Against Racism had been formed in reaction to statements by Eric Clapton and David Bowie unbelievably, and so that had been formed. That was always growing, and the specials supported that, and in fact it probably influenced the actual makeup of the specials, because when I formed the specials, it was very it was definitely intended to be a multiracial band. That was a conscious decision by me when I put the lineup together. It didn't just sort of happen, and it was definitely trying to combine punk and reggae initially as the two main sort of, there was an affinity between punk and reggae, or supposedly anyway, as kind of rebellious music or whatever. So that anti-racism was always part of my makeup, really, and so that carried into Two Tone, and that always had a strong anti-racist stance, which wasn't, it didn't directly mention apartheid until after the first lineup of the specials had, the Funboy 3 had left but I carried on under the name of the Special AKA. And I think that album, I made a fairly conscious effort to make that album more, a bit more international politically. I think there was a song about the situation in with regard to Israel, and I also did a I went to Nelson Mandela's I think it was 65th birthday at the Alexandra Palace, which was organised by the anti-apartheid movement. It was a concert with a lot of South African exile bands, Julian Bahula, I can particularly remember singing a song about Mandela. And to be honest, I hadn't heard of Nelson Mandela till then. And, you know, it seemed to... I was already working on a tune instrumentally, which was kind of quite an up thing. I was listening to a bit of African music at the time. And I had this tune, and then I put the lyrics to this tune that I was already working on. And I don't know, it just seemed like, you know, it was easier to relate to one person's story. It seemed to work on me, so I don't know. I just used his name, but it did contain the line, "Only one man in a large army." So it was Rhoda Decker contributed that line, which I think was important. And, yeah, the rest is history. The song luckily got played on Radio 1 because the people who plugged records at Radio 1 were Specials fans, so they, you know, it was quite unusual for something as so-called political as that to get played. But anyway, it did, because it had a very catchy tune, obviously, and that became a hit, and it went to number one in New Zealand. It was a hit around the world. Incredibly, it started being played inside South Africa in football stadiums, and that was on the news. That was amazing to see that, to being smuggled in to South Africa, because I think the UDF and probably the ANC as well used to use football matches to make speeches over the tannoy systems, because that was the only place that black people were allowed to gather, and that, you know, occasionally things would come over the speakers, and that was incredible to see that on the news. Anyway, so then after that, Dali Tambo, the son of Oliver Tambo, the exiled president of the ANC, approached me to form British Artists Against Apartheid, which there was also Artists United Against Apartheid in America, Little Steve, and I can't remember which was formed first, but around the same time. And he had a song, "Ain't Gonna Play Sun City," which obviously was supporting the sanctions campaign and asking artists to observe the United Nations cultural boycott and not go to South Africa. Anyway, so I then met, Dali also introduced me to someone called Chandra Shaker, who was in the process of organising an anti-apartheid gig in Brixton and Fridge, a small gig with the Potato Five, and that became Artists Against Apartheid's first concert. We also had a launch with, Bob Geldof came, various people came, and the aim of Artists Against Apartheid was twofold. One, to try and persuade artists to observe the boycott of South Africa, not sell records there, not go there, not play there, not, to completely boycott anything to do with it, so that it, you know, there was no, this facade of normality could be destroyed. And the other was to organise concerts in this country to raise awareness, raise funds for either anti-apartheid movement or ANC, and generally, you know, help the anti-apartheid movement in its campaigning. to free Nelson Mandela as well, obviously, and all the political prisoners. So the concerts grew from this little small start at the Fridge. We did concerts with New Order and Billy Bragg in Sheffield. The Smiths, well, it was originally at the Albert Hall, but it, I think someone was hurt in a car crash, and so it had to be postponed. That was at the Academy eventually, with Pete Shelley supporting. Madness and Gil Scott-Heron, unbelievably, at the Academy in Brixton. That was a great gig. Pogues and Elvis Costello, that was in France, in Paris. There's a UB40 did a gig, Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, Working Week, James, the Bundu Boys, the Communards, Terence Trent D'Arby and Smiley Culture. I think that might have been the Albert Hall. There's one in Edinburgh with Curtis Mayfield and Michelle Schacht, which was fantastic to have Curtis Mayfield on board. We got the Blow Monkeys to put our banner up, but they were supporting Rod Stewart, of all people. So, you know, these gigs got more and more and bigger, and it built up and built up. And then, you know, we always worked closely with the anti-apartheid movement on all this. And then it was decided that we were going to do a huge event on Clapham Common, you know, which I you know, personally put the line-up together and approached all the artists. And that was absolutely huge, with 250,000 people, or at least 200,000. It was a fantastic summer's day. We had Peter Gabriel, Hugh Masekela, Gil Scott-Heron, who was the sort of godfather of anti-apartheid movement in the West, really, with his anthem Johannesburg, which we all knew about, and that obviously inspired us all. You know, Peter Gabriel, obviously, with his song Biko, was another key Western anti-apartheid song, which inspired me as well to write Free Nelson Mandela. So that was really those three songs were kind of linked in that way, in terms of inspiration. Yeah, and we had Hugh Masekela there, Sting, Sade, Maxi Priest, a reggae artist, obviously. We had Sir Coxon sound system around the back of the stage. So it was a very, you know, it was, every effort was made to make sure there was plenty of black music and black people involved, which there were on the day. Style Council, Lorna G, another reggae artist, Boy George, Big Audio Dynamite, Gary Kemp, who, I guess it was interesting that there were two people on this stage who'd been given their first instruments by Trevor Huddleston. One was Hugh Masekela, who Trevor Huddleston gave his first trumpet. He gave him his first trumpet, and he also gave Gary Kemp his first guitar. So Trevor Huddleston's spirit was very much a part of this. You know, his importance in all this can't be overstated, you know. Princess was there, Elvis Costello, Junior, Giscombe, and... yeah, it was a huge day. It was the proudest day of my life, really. I can remember it. I played some records, and we also, you know, all got together and sung Free Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was obviously still in prison at that time. Yeah, and it was an amazing day. I can remember it was funny because there was a fashion for Dayglow tops at that time, especially among the black community. And I can remember looking across Clapham Common, 250,000 people, and for some reason I was just reminded of that X-ray Specs song, The Day the World Turned Dayglow. It was such an amazing sight. There's also, yeah, did I mention Big Audio Dynamite? I think I did. At the end, the police wanted to close it down, and Big Audio Dynamite was still playing, and they were saying, you know, you've got to turn this off, you've got to turn it off. But Big Audio Dynamite had only been on for 5 minutes or something, so we locked the door of the generator and pretended we'd lost the key, and we're all running around, where's the key, we can't find the key, we can't turn it off. So that was quite funny. And yeah, it was just an amazing day, and I think it's true to say it was the largest anti-apartheid demonstration anywhere in the world at that time that had ever happened. So you know, that was my proudest day, really, because I did put that all together myself, the bill, and invited all those artists personally. And it's also worth mentioning that we also had an amazing club going all through these 2 years that this was happening. We had a little club down in the basement youth club in Covent Garden. We had some of the hottest kind of hip hop DJs at the time in house, when all that was really happening, and exciting new music. We had Tim Westwood, we had Jazzy B twice, later From Soul to Soul, Cold Cut, Rhythm Doc, Derek B, Adrian Sherwood from Anu Sound, The Wild Bunch, who later sort of mutated into Massive Attack. And so that was an amazing little thing, and that's how we paid our expenses. We ran all this from a tiny office, which was in the Institute of Education, and we just paid for the cost of it with this little club that I never got paid at all, 4 years' work. Chandra only got paid the last year from the proceeds for this club, so you know, there was a lot of hard work involved. And all this time we were sending out leaflets to artists urging them to boycott South Africa, not to sell records there, to put a clause in their contracts, you know, when they signed contracts, not to sell records. And I think, you know, it did have an effect on the, you know, some artists did stop selling records in South Africa. And it became, you know, that obviously made the situation, put pressure on, because I guess the white South African youngsters, you know, what wanted a normal life, and you know, it would help focus their minds and get them to support the struggle to end apartheid. End apartheid, which, you know, to some extent, of course, some of them did, you know, to varying degrees, and some, you know, I think it all helped. Similarly with the rugby boycott, you know, there must have been a feeling amongst white South Africans that this can't go on, we want a normal life, you know. And that all helped put pressure on, hopefully. Yeah, so that's the story, really, of the Artists Against Apartheid. Oh, yeah, and then from after Clapham Common, we decided that, well, you know, I can remember saying, we can't go back to small concerts or academy-sized concerts. We've got to go from here to something as big, if not bigger. You know, we can't be seen to be taking a step back, although I think there was one small concert that someone organised. And, you know, very shortly afterwards, Tony Wheeler, who produced Clapham Common, put together a proposal, and we decided that we wanted to do the next... Well, the Clapham Common concert had actually cost the anti-apartheid movement... I think it was about £30,000. So they were pretty much out of pocket, and it was decided that the next concert would have to be a paying concert, Oh, hang on. I want to just give some big up someone before that. For the Clapham Common concert, we went to various DJs and Radio 1 and asked them to publicise the concert and on Clapham Common. And one of our most adamant supporters, it's got to be said, was Tony Blackburn, who had the morning show on Radio London. I mean, I think John Peel mentioned it a couple of times on his show and he supported it. But Tony Blackburn, every day for weeks, he went on and on about this concert and how appalled he was by apartheid. He had the Soul show on Radio London and he was very popular, especially amongst the black community. And I think he played a huge part in making that event as big and successful as it was, especially amongst the black community. And, you know, maybe people wouldn't think of Tony Blackburn as a particularly political person, but on that particular issue, he was really strong, so I can't emphasise enough, you know, the thanks to him for that. I think he did. It was funny because, you know, the old rivalry between, he was supposedly the straight guy and John Peel was supposedly the rebel, but actually he supported it much more than John Peel. Although John Peel did support it, I'm not dissing him because he did give it a couple of mentions, but nothing like the extent to which Tony Black... But that was interesting anyway. Yeah, so back to the story. After Clapham Common, it was decided in conversation with the anti-apartheid movement, always, you know, we worked very closely, that we wanted to do something. It would have to be a paid gig, so we were either going to fence off a park and charge people to come in, or it was going to be in a stadium, a sports stadium, either in London, possibly up north, possibly even Scotland. And the first person I remember suggesting Wembley was someone called Jeff Wilkinson, who later had a band called Us Three, who was sort of involved. And then this idea was circulated, and, you know, I was saying, well, that's a great idea, but we have to have an artist, you know, big enough to fill Wembley Stadium, or more or less fill it, because I can't remember, the deposit on Wembley Stadium was something like £70,000. Nobody had that kind of money. So we had to get an artist. We approached various artists for that year, for the year after Clapham Common. It was, the original date was about a year later. And Dire Straits said they supported us, but they weren't in touring mode. And they were very friendly, and they said they'd like to do something, but maybe come back next year. They might be in touring mode, but they couldn't do anything at that time. And we kept sort of circulating and asking people. Simple Minds' Jim Kerr did eventually come back, but it was too late for that year. But anyway, he said he really wanted to do something. And that's really where the ball started rolling for Wembley. Then around that time, Tony Hollingsworth appeared, and he had some money, which, as far as I remember, he said he had it from left over from the GLC, because obviously Margaret Thatcher had closed down the GLC, and he had, so he said he had possibly some money to pay the deposit. And so we went back to Dire Straits then, and I can remember signing the letter, and this time we said that, you know, Simple Minds were on board. It looked like a possibility. And I was still saying, don't pay the deposit until we've got, you know, an artist big enough to fill it. And, but Dire Straits came back with a positive, yeah. And I know that they spoke to Simple Minds behind the scenes, and they said, if you do it, we'll do it. But they said they wanted to be top of the bill, Dire Straits, which was fine by Simple Minds. They were a huge, huge band at that time, Dire Straits. So then the the ball really started rolling, and I think that you know, the anti-apartheid movement and Mike Terry were very involved in all these discussions. Yeah, so once Dire Straits came on board, then it became feasible to put down the deposit. I can remember saying that, you know, the next important thing was really to have a major black artist, so it wasn't just a rock gig, because that just would not have worked. So I was still holding back. I was still saying, you know, just wait a minute, you know, just like, let's get a really major artist. I think Tony Hollingsworth said B.B. King, which is great, and I love B.B. King, you know, to the max. But I can remember saying, you know, that we needed someone of a equal kind of standing to Dire Straits, you know, a Stevie Wonder or somebody. And I think that, you know, various contacts were made with the American Artists Against Apartheid, Harry Belafonte and various people over there. And eventually Whitney Houston came through, and that's when it, right, now all the important parts of the jigsaw are in place. You know, now this can really go ahead. And, you know, it was already moving ahead, but I can remember putting that pressure on. I can remember persuading the Eurythmics, who were, I think, were a bit reluctant at first. I spoke to Dave Stewart on the phone. Anyway, by that time I was more or less totally exhausted, and I kind of, Tony had been taken on as producer, and I more or less handed over to him, and the rest is history, as we know. You know, in that very first Tony Wheeler proposal, I mean, I've still got it, straight after Clapham Common, it was, he said from the beginning that TV should be definitely involved, wherever it was, whether it was in a fenced off park or another stadium, or it was felt that, you know, really it was a shame that TV wasn't involved in the Clapham Common thing, but you know, that was part of the plan from day one, you know. So it was, you know, the first Wembley concert was an Artists Against Apartheid event, and it was under that banner, you know. And you know, so, you know, credit to Dali Tambo for starting it. And, you know, there was a definite link through from Clapham Common. And, you know, then it obviously snowballed and went global, which was fantastic. And all this time, you know, it was helping build the campaign. It was helping popularise Nelson Mandela's name. And I think it's definitely true that you know, once it was on the TV for a whole day, you know, the politicians around the world had to take note. They could see there were votes in this thing. They could see how popular it was becoming. So, you know, they had to actually take action and, you know, go and tell the apartheid regime that they had to change. You know, I think, you know, it's hard to quantify, but I think it all helps. But I always say, like, any campaign is like a clock. You know, the smallest cog is as important as the biggest cog. And, you know, obviously what we did was absolutely nothing compared with, you know, people giving their lives in South Africa. And, you know, this was, in fact, you know, I don't look, there was some fantastic moments, obviously, and it was, you know, it worked in the end. But it was also, I was also very much aware, I don't look back on that period as, I've got mixed feelings, because you were aware that you were supporting people who were putting their lives at risk and facing gunfire, more or less unarmed. We were supporting them from a distance. Our lives weren't in any real danger or anything. And likewise with the sanctions campaign, you know, you were aware that the people you were helping would in the short term be suffering from that. And so that was, you know, it was almost like it was a war situation. So I don't have any nostalgia for that. I don't have, you know, there's no such thing as anti-apartheid nostalgia in my book, because it was an extremely nasty regime, and and people had to face up to it more or less unarmed, and they were getting shot and killed. And you know, Dulcie September, the ANC rep in Paris, someone walked in the office and shot her through the head, you know. And the ANC officers in London were firebombed. It wasn't, you know, it was really an unpleasant period, you know. So, you know, I've got mixed feelings, although obviously there were great achievements in getting rid of it, but it shouldn't have never been there in the first place, you know. To pay the deposit. And yeah, so we went back to Dire Straits then, and I can remember signing the letter. And this time we said that, you know, Simple Minds were on board. It looked like a possibility. And I was still saying, don't pay the deposit until we've got, you know, an artist big enough to fill it. And yeah, but Dire Straits came back with a positive, yeah. And I know that they spoke to Simple Minds behind the scenes, and they said, if you do it, we'll do it. But they said they wanted to be top of the bill, Dire Straits, which was fine by Simple Minds. They were a huge, huge band at that time, Dire Straits. So then the ball really started rolling, and I think that, you know, the anti-apartheid movement and Mike Terry were very involved in all these discussions. Yeah, so once Dire Straits came on board, then it became feasible to put down the deposit. I can remember saying that, you know, the next important thing was really to have a major black artist, so it wasn't just a rock gig, because that just would not have worked. So I was still holding back. I was still saying, you know, just wait a minute, you know, just like, let's get a really major artist. I think Tony Hollingsworth said B.B. King, which is great, and I love B.B. King, you know, to the max. But I can remember saying, you know, that we needed someone of a equal kind of standing to Dire Straits, you know, a Stevie Wonder or somebody. And I think that, you know, various contacts were made with the American Artists Against Apartheid, Harry Belafonte, and various people over there. And eventually Whitney Houston came through, and that's when it, right, now all the important parts of the jigsaw are in place, you know, now this can really go ahead. And, you know, it was already moving ahead, but I can remember putting that pressure on. I can remember persuading the Eurythmics, who were, I think, were a bit reluctant at first. I spoke to Dave Stewart on the phone. Anyway, by that time I was more or less totally exhausted, and I kind of, Tony had been taken on as producer, and I more or less handed over to him, and the rest is history, as we know. You know, in that very first Tony Wheeler proposal, I mean, I've still got it, straight after Clapham Common, it was, he said from the beginning that TV should be definitely involved, wherever it was, whether it was in a fenced off park or another stadium, or it was felt that, you know, really it was a shame that TV wasn't involved in the Clapham Common thing, but you know, that was part of the plan from day one, you know. So it was, you know, the first Wembley concert was an Artists Against Apartheid event, and it was under that banner, you know. And you know, so, you know, credit to Dali Tambo for starting it. And, you know, there was a definite link through from Clapham Common. And, you know, then it obviously snowballed and went global, which was fantastic. And all this time, you know, it was helping build the campaign. It was helping popularise Nelson Mandela's name. And I think it's definitely true that you know, once it was on the TV for a whole day, you know, politicians around the world had to take note. They could see there were votes in this thing. They could see how popular it was becoming. So, you know, they had to actually take action and, you know, go and tell the apartheid regime that they had to change. You know, I think, you know, it's hard to quantify, but I think it all helps. But I always say, like, any campaign is like a clock. You know, the smallest cog is as important as the biggest cog. And, you know, obviously what we did was absolutely nothing compared with, you know, people giving their lives in South Africa. And, you know, this was, in fact, you know, I don't look, there was some fantastic moments, obviously, and it was, you know, it worked in the end, but it was also, I was also very much aware, I don't look back on that period as, I've got mixed feelings, because you were aware that you were supporting people who were putting their lives at risk and facing gunfire, more or less unarmed. We were supporting them from a distance. Our lives weren't in any real danger or anything. And likewise with the sanctions campaign, you know, you were aware that the people you were helping would, in the short term, be suffering from that. And so that was, you know, it was almost like it was a war situation. So I don't have any nostalgia for that. I don't have, you know, there's no such thing as anti-apartheid nostalgia in my book, because it was an extremely nasty regime, and people had to face up to it more or less unarmed, and they were getting shot and killed. And you know, Dulcie September, the ANC rep in Paris, someone walked in the office and shot her through the head, you know. The ANC offices in London were firebombed. It wasn't, you know, it was really an unpleasant period, you know. So, you know, I've got mixed feelings, although obviously there were great achievements in getting rid of it, but it shouldn't have never been there in the first place, you know.